I want to thank all of you for showing up. I know it's kind of towards the end of South by Southwest, and it's a marathon. So just getting across the finish line is part of the battle and experience of South by Southwest. My name is Matt Escobel. I work for the city of Austin. I've been working for the city almost 13 years now, and I'm happy to be part of this panel. I'll be moderating the panel today and doing a little bit of an introduction to the ideas behind, you know, what's happening in government and why are we always looking to the private sector to say, you know, I wish we could do that. And so I don't know how many of you got to see today's keynote with Jen Palka, but it was a great setup for our discussion today, because I think we have an example here in Austin that will do a lot to really illustrate the points that she discussed in her presentation and kind of give some examples. I'm going to let each person who's presenting on the panel introduce themselves and kind of their backgrounds and where they come from. But I think you're going to get to see that there's a lot of unique viewpoints in this space, and that there's an opportunity for all of us to really kind of to take control of being citizens in the community and helping government get to where it needs to be. And I think that's the challenge in front of us all. My presentation may be a little tongue-in-cheek, perhaps, because I think if we don't have a sense of humor about where government is, we're all just going to go crazy. So I'm going to go ahead and get started. And the very first slide is a slide that always was very personal to me when this campaign came out about I'm a PC and I'm a Mac. I don't know why, but I always felt like in government, we're the PC. That's pretty obvious why. If you look at the presentation that Jen gave as well of all the different screenshots of different systems that you use in government, we're in many cases 10 years behind. And I think that was something that was always very particular about these ads was you had somebody kind of in an ill-fitting suit that, you know, it looked like, you know, he bought during a previous administration, like maybe Nixon, perhaps, or Reagan. It's an old suit. He doesn't look progressive, doesn't look like he's moving forward. And then you have kind of like the cool hipster guy. He probably did something really cool, designed a really cool website, whatever he did with the Mac. I always kind of felt like this is government and this is the industry. So it's something that we wanted to kind of say is like there is perception that really kind of aligns with this campaign about PC versus Mac. It's government versus industry in terms of the context of how we're perceived. Here's an idea about where we work. Where is the source of innovation? In the left, it may be a slight exaggeration of the office area that I currently occupy, but not much. The lighting is about the same. The cubicle structure is about the same. The hangar that's resting on the side of that is about the same. When we look at companies that we aspire to try to match or to see where the innovation is happening, it's happening in spaces like that. And that's not entirely true for everybody, but you will see that some of these leaders in technology, the ones who are setting the bar for what people are used to using every day, Facebook, Google, Twitter, all these cool places, whether you're talking technology or advertising, a lot of creativity and innovation comes from the places where they work and the environments that they exist in. It's really hard on a day-to-day basis to go to work every day and say, like, I'm going to innovate when the hum of the light above you and the conversations that are happening, they're just not moving in the direction that is sharing and collaborative. And I think you see that in these images. It's how we work. And this illustration here really kind of shows, again, another example or extension of that analogy. You have a guy who's digging a hole with a whole lot of people watching and participating very passively, but with very prominent roles in this project. The human resources manager, the marketing manager, the logistic manager, security manager, IT, all collaborating very well on this project. Not a lot's getting done in this process. It shows kind of the levels of bureaucracy that you frequently have to navigate through, and in some cases, the perception, again, that there's a lot of waste in government. On the right, you get the opportunity to see kind of a more collaborative space. You see that everybody's actively engaged. You kind of have an idea that everybody's contributing to the discussion and to the identification of a solution. These are kind of principles that I think government really needs to look at in terms of changing how things happen. Again, slight exaggerations here, but in many cases not. The more levels of bureaucracy that you get, the more times you have people standing around watching and commenting, but not actually doing the work. And so that's kind of an important piece that we have to consider when we talk about how can government change. Again, kind of to go back to the keynote, one of the ideas is that change has to happen internally. There has to be a change inside of government, but there also has to be a change outside of government. And so I think this, or there's examples outside of government that we could bring in to help us make that change. And so I just want to kind of actually move forward with the idea that it's not just government alone that faces this challenge. I think anytime you have a big organization, you're going to have challenges with bureaucracy and how to get things done efficiently. And I kind of like this image here because it kind of shows the fact that the larger you get, the smaller your playing field sometimes is to be able to do what you need to do. More restrictions get put in place, more processes get put in place, and often it's those things that really kind of stand in the way of innovation and stand in the way of you getting to where you need to go. Big fish, little bowl. On the right is kind of how I see the industry, is like oftentimes you take that startup mentality of taking bite-sized pieces out of a big problem, and all of a sudden the area you have to work in is so much bigger. The range of solutions grows exponentially. And so that's kind of something that I think I wanted to bring home, is that it's really kind of the idea of how you approach problems. For us, I think the idea is that you look at different business models like startup companies, like the private sector, and say what works for them, how can we use that to make our organization operate more nimbly. Real briefly, the Austin, Texas story. I'm not sure how many of you have followed the Austin, Texas story, but one of the key projects that we've been working on was the redesign of the City of Austin website. This project really kind of took about 3 years to get off the ground, and it was really an example of pretty much everything that's wrong with government, in that we had many different procurement procedures we had to follow. We had changes in leadership, changes in philosophy about how things were going to get done, and when it all came down to it, and we actually got to kind of the breaking point of realizing, you know, none of these processes are going to work for us to get this project done. One thing that we did have, and I'm glad that Doug Matthews is here, is that we had the change in leadership that brought us kind of the confidence and the courage to decide that it's okay to do something different. Doug Matthews is our corporate director of the Public Information Office, and then Steve Elkins, who's our CIO, is the other person who I really credit for kind of having the courage to say, let's do something different. And what we did differently is that we just said, you know, no more failed RFPs. We're going to do this project in-house, and we're going to do it using an open-source solution. And so we built the new website using Drupal 7. It took us about 3 years to get there. It took us about 7 months to build it. And so that was a really good example of what you could do if you were able to dedicate your resources, kind of break free of all the hoops that you have to jump through, and actually be able to work. And so I think that's one of the great proving points that we had with this project. The second thing is the data.austin.texas.gov is our City of Austin data portal. And admittedly, it's very humble right now. We have about 35 data sets currently on the portal. But our plans are to expand and grow as kind of the need in the community grows. One of the key things I wanted to point out here is that this launched at the same time as we did the website redesign project. So actually, it was really two projects that launched at the same time that really kind of furthered the city's ability to kind of deliver more services, to deliver more opportunities for others to develop their services, and to really to take a chance to move forward with innovation as a whole. So you need the courage to change, and I kind of addressed that already, but you know, a big organization can find a way to cross all the different challenges that are in front of it. Again, for us, it's having a champion. It's having people committed to change and a willingness to try something different. Transformations are possible. And this is just my little analogy here. For the geek in all of us, who wants to see the geek transform and actually succeed? One of my favorite movies, Revenge of the Nerds. You start as a geek, but you end up as the awesome new wave band. You might be George McFly, the failed and frustrated government employee, but who ends up being the award-winning author of science fiction. Not so much a transition here, but you can take an analogy of the Flintstones to the Jetsons. This is the kind of change we're trying to make to try to keep pace with government. The last one, of course, is Office Space, which, of course, you have Milton. And I'll use the analogy that he burnt down Innotech, meaning that he burnt down the processes. And in the end, he enjoyed his time on the beach in Mexico. So we're hoping that we're able to get to these transformation stages in government. The last slide of my presentation is really kind of highlighting what the city of Austin did and what we believe will help other governments succeed in this area is to first embrace open source opportunities wherever you can. One of the challenges in government are the huge contracts and licenses and enterprise solutions for everything. Open source gives us an opportunity to create and to share and to not have to do parallel projects that other cities are doing. We want to kind of engage the idea of agile development in government, which is a very rare concept, to be able to be responsive to the changes that occur in technology as opposed to making sure every requirement is exactly right and everything that a project requires in our existing framework is just so heavy that we want to make sure that that gets lighter and that we're able to respond quickly. Austin was a huge benefit for the city of Austin, and I'm going to let Julio talk about that next. But that's a community group that assembled as part of just pure frustration with the RFP process that the web redesign project went through. Basically, they kind of had enough, and they started as a crowdsourcing group that said, we can help you guys. That group has since transformed to kind of be an ally for us to help us plan our strategy and to help us kind of look at what the solutions are and to kind of bring that expertise from the local tech community, which is very rich in Austin, to really help us out. And then lastly is Code for America. And, we're a partner city this year, and it's something we're very proud of. For us, it's kind of the extension of everything that we've been trying to do for years is now formalized through the Code for America group. And we're really optimistic that it's a great building block from the platform that we built using open source, having an open data portal, that now we'll be able to show others what we can do. And so I kind of wanted to just start with the problem statement and kind of show you a path. I'm going to let these guys talk now and get into the details of how they're able to impact the city's government here in Austin.
Can you hear me? Things are messed up, y'all. Trust is down. This is a problem for those of us that believe that government can do things as has an obligation to provide important public goods, because we live in a democracy, and a democracy that taxes its people significantly. Without trust, we cannot launch the programs. We cannot make the change happen. Why is trust down? That's a complicated question. I can't answer it, and I won't answer it today. I have my own ideas. In part, it has to do with economics. In part, it has to do with significant mistakes done by people in government in the past. I know we need to fix it, and I know we need to fix it if we want to change things. My name is Julio González Zamirano. I'm a member of Open Austin, which is a local volunteer grassroots group advocating for open data and open government. I'm going to tell you what we've done, but more interested I am in telling you what to do. I'm interested in telling you a few pointers that we've learned, and I hope that you believe in science. I believe in science, and I hope that you believe in organizing. I hope that you believe in using science in organizing. if you believe in open government and open data, here are some ideas for you, and here are some pointers for you about how we can create a movement that is effective in transforming our society. First, social movement research says it's important to have a theory of change. There are two reasons for this. One, you have to know what you're doing. Second, to avoid free ridership. I'm going to talk about that more in a little bit. We have a simple theory of change, but there's one word in particular that I think is very important for those of us that believe in open data and open government. We believe that we're trying to create, through collective action, a gain in electoral and bureaucratic power. Power. To open government and its data. It is not necessarily just about volunteerism, and it is not just about providing the labor for application development. It is about taking control of resources that are public. If we can then liberate the data and empower public sector entrepreneurs like Matt, then hopefully improved attitudes towards government follow, restoring trust. Not only through tactical things like, wow, rounded corners on the website. This is a good experience. I believe in government again. But by changing how people think of government. Here are some other pointers. Number two, if there was a metrics of movement building, right at the top have to be, are you having one-on-one organizing conversations? In the mid-90s, when I was a college student, I read a book called Collective Action in the Civil Rights Movement. Nobody else read this book except the people in this section. If you go to Amazon today, you can buy it for $4. There is no Kindle edition. But this was a very powerful book because it looked at why is it that in the Civil Rights Movement, people went to a bridge to get beat up when they didn't have to make change? How is it possible that all of the people that could have free-ridden, let somebody else get beat up, chose to go and get beat up? Well, the stakes are not as high when we're asking our friends to give us a little bit more data, but the dilemma is the same. And the answer that this rational choice theorist posed, Dennis Chung, was, in part, you've got to expose people's reputation to failure to collectively act. So when I talked to that gentleman, who some of you met yesterday, James Deloney, for the first time, a very involved transit activist who I knew we needed on our team, what I wanted to get to know was not what he thought about a RESTful API, which he doesn't have a strong opinion, or what the first app should be. I wanted to know about him as a person, what motivated him, what he thought about power. I wanted him to trust me. If you are an open government startup committed to organizing one-on-one conversations and the density of people that can have those one-on-one conversations to expose people's reputation so that collective action can happen has to be your number one metric. Number two, it's important to visibly target the median voter because we're trying to take power in government so that we can allocate how public goods are put into the system. We have to care about the underlying structure, which is one of democracy. In Austin, we have essentially 7 city council members because the mayor doesn't have veto power. And they are inevitably elected in a two-person race because we have runoff voting. What that means is that the conventional median voter theorem applies, which basically means that any politician that is interested in their re-election is going to look for 50% plus one. So whomever that person that is at the median, what their opinions are really matter. As you know from federal elections, sadly, oftentimes that person's opinions probably should not matter. But nonetheless, that is a problem that we had. So when we decided to begin focusing on advocacy, it was very important that we start talking about things like a questionnaire. And it was the first time that we ran an AdWords campaign. The spike that you see there is around election time, to try and be visible, not necessarily just for the actual median voter because we wanted to persuade them, but more importantly, if you remember that old Saul Alinsky rule, right, of it doesn't matter what you have in terms of a base of power, it is more important what people perceive. And because only, 5 to 6% of people vote, and because at top there's about 100 elite policy activists and political cooperatives in the municipal government, all of them, I can assure you, saw our ad. So they knew that we had some kind of base or power. It's important to establish reciprocity with advocates. There you see three of our city council people, including one of our core champions. This is sort of a trivial example, but it's an important example nonetheless, and one that I hope that you integrate into your organizing philosophy. Reciprocity, like, you know, Gialdini's influence teaches us, it's very important in terms of being able to get the things that you need from people. However, there are less trivial examples and some that those of us that are in movement building have to embrace. It's important to write checks to your advocates. It's important to nominate them for recognition. It is important to talk in the small circles of decision makers positively about them because everybody's a gossip and so the information luckily gets back to them. This is how you solidify who your advocates and champions are. Seek institutionalization. Some of you probably were inflicted with reading a book called The End of Liberalism, which is not about what we think of as liberalism. It has to do with how bureaucracies end up getting captured. This is a guy named Chip, who some of you met. Chip is in many ways a nexus of different points of influence in community technology policy. And at the time that we began our advocacy, he was the chair of the Community Technology and Telecommunications Committee. Because we have weak mayor, these bureaucratic points of influence is where policy gets made, or in our case, overlooked. So it was very important for us to go and organize and engage folks like that. As part of our open government framework, probably a more important part of what we did was pass a three-sentence change to the ordinance that affects this committee, giving it formal authority to have oversight over open data and open government matters. In other words, we inserted a veto point into the local process around the issues that are important to us in the sort of sad, lowy, but proven tradition. One of the things that we now have to do is change the culture. If you are a manager of a public sector organization, why are you going to take a risk on something before an app is ready? There are actually very few examples, and this is today's example of an agency scorecard on data sets. This is from San Francisco. I think it could use a little bit of gamification, maybe some badges. I think some badges would go a long way towards getting the folks at the bottom at the Recreation and Park Department to get out more data. I think we want to do a version of this in Austin. I think we want to adjust for FTE. I don't think it's fair to, say, put the Department of Public Works up against, I don't know, the rent board. But in any event, it's important for people to see that things are happening, that other folks are putting out data. Right now, if you look at our platforms and a lot of folks' open data portals, it's really unclear sort of who's doing the most. You can see what's the most looked at data set is. In Chicago, it's people's salaries for whatever reason. I can make that short for you. People in the public sector get paid very little. But it's important to use social proof to change how the bureaucracy thinks about giving you data. Being selective is very important. Code for America, part of, I think, the reason that it resonates and it makes people feel like it's important is because it is selective. DARPA, the Navy SEALs, those are public sector agencies that people trust and revere because they are selective and elite. I think one of the things that we want to do in Austin is something like this because it is selective and elite. It conveys a sense that, therefore, it has scarcity and value. Which is another Gialdini finding and proven in other places. It is part of how we will reiterate to people the ability of government to get things done. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Suzanne Mettler's work. I was very pleased that Open Austin changed its mindset from saying we are going to have our own open data portal and our own interface to it is important to have it in the government's sphere. Suzanne Mettler's research basically points out that when you ask the Americans if they are recipients of a government program, Americans who actually indeed have received the following types of programs say that they have not. So for example, if you ask most Americans, do you receive a government program, specifically the home mortgage interest deduction, 60% of people say, nope, I haven't gotten a program. More troubling are things at the bottom, like folks do not know that Medicare is a government program, which leads to the famous sort of get the government out of my Medicare. People on Social Security, folks on student loans. The submerged state, which is her concept, is not just it's not just as banal, oh, people are so stupid. it's a significant problem in that these are remarkable investments. Are you raising your hand?
Yeah.
People don't know that they're the recipient of the public investment. So those of us that rent are subsidizing you homeowners who are getting this deduction. So I as a renter, am subsidizing your homeownership through my income tax. You think you deserve that, or you think that that's an immutable natural state. It is not. It is a subsidy. And the people don't know that, and the way that it distorts a variety of things is that submerged state, that people walk around being like, well, look at me, I have won in the meritocracy, look at my big subsidized sprawling suburban home. Well, that is not merit, and you didn't win that. It is part of the problem of the submerged state. So for us, in our applications and in the open data portal, it is so important that people know that it is a public program that has been funded with public dollars. Originally, we didn't have any data, so even if we had folks that had software development skills, we didn't have anything to do. So this was sort of an initial a scheme for how we were going to organize. And as you see, advocates, wonky people like me, who in their day jobs, you know, do Java on the server side, so we're not very sexy, we were kind of important. But I have now sort of become obsolete in terms of what the organization has to become next, which is a place full of Max Ogdens and folks that can actually produce applications and change how we use data for the better. One of the dilemmas as you build your organization is to not fall into this trap that various sociologists, you know, commonly identify of the charismatic leader. In Austin, we have a variety of organizations, many of them environmental, who unfortunately have become trapped to the charismatic leader and therefore cannot think proactively about the new environmental needs or the new communities that face environmental justice issues because those organizations have become fused with that individual. This is a dilemma both for me, but probably for many of you as you go into your organizing. One final point is, if you look at who we wanted to do last, it's folks who presently in our organizing do not have a lot of software development skills or a lot of time. These are folks that are in some ways marginal. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to win the oppression Olympics. It doesn't mean we have to go and find a person of color who is handicapped, who just got here, who doesn't speak the language, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But folks that are not within the world that we commonly interact with at elite occasions like this or already the levels of power, teaching those folks how to build a web app is what is truly transformative and ultimately the ultimate aspiration that I have for the organization. We have done a bad job of broadening our coalition based on the public good that we're providing. Many of you are probably familiar with this concept. Agri-subsidies was originally social insurance for farmers. How it became something that Frito-Lay came to care a lot about is part of what we need to learn from. Part of it is we have to look beyond folks that care about web applications to folks like journalists, data journalists, as well as folks that I would say live in Excel world as opposed to Ruby or PHP world, folks that need to evaluate programs, folks that are interested in evaluating how charitable giving works, folks generally interested in social impact. So there are those pointers, and I would just want to conclude with a concern. So as you can probably figure, I'm an egalitarian, and I care deeply about the vast types of inequality, economic, who has the money, political, whose voices matter, cultural, which identities are privileged in America and in the world today. I'm primarily an American, and so that's the experience that we'll talk about. I'm concerned that even though we are building more transparency in terms of data, better user experiences, rounded corners, new forms of public services and public service, we are not going back to those three economic, political, cultural forms of inequality in the type of organizing that we are doing around open government and open data. If you want to see signs of change, you should look for the signs. Confrontations with existing forms of power in the status quo that require public displays of solidarity. Many of you probably haven't seen Norma Rae. It's a movie about union organizing. At the end of the movie, she doesn't say data, she says union. I was in a union when I was a dishwasher in college. It taught me a lot about what it means to not be afraid of changing the status quo. I don't think, because I know folks like Doug and obviously like Matt, that the types of confrontations that we're going to have are necessarily going to be that nasty, and they definitely have not been. It's actually a very nice technocratic scene, open government and open data, and it's about ROI and stakeholders. But I feel that we might be missing something. I want a world where people with signs say, what is the algorithm that is allocating these police patrols? Why is this algorithm now in the public space? I want people to say, please don't buy an SPSS license, buy an R license, because this is our platform and we want to invest in collective public goods as opposed to private profits. I want people to say, smarter cities is not smart for us. We are going to build our own platform. We are going to build our own type of government. We're going to build tools that are, again, not about private benefits, but about public goods. Thank you.
Okay, that's a tough one to follow. My name is Kevin Curry. I'm the program director for Code for America Brigade, and I thank you for the opportunity to spend a few minutes, just about 5 minutes, to tell you what the brigade is and why it's important, it's a way you can get involved, and why it's relevant to this conversation. So the Code for America Brigade is an organizing force for designers, developers, marketers, leaders, to use their talents to change and improve the way their cities and communities operate. It's about hacking as a civic duty. And when you see that word hacking, I don't want you to get hung up on coding. I mean, we're Code for America. We like to code. It's obvious. But there's policy hacking. There's process hacking. There's a lot of different ways that we can use these talents to change the way our governments operate and the way our communities can provide better services to our citizens. You know, it's kind of like this, right? It's ask not what your city can do for you, ask what you can do for your city. Now, I was born in 1970, so I was born after this. But my parents raised me on the value of civic duty and helping out their communities. And when I found out about Code for America, when I found out about open government and transparency and Gov2.0, I realized that that was my opportunity to contribute. And I hope that for you guys, you realize it's your opportunity to contribute as well. And so that's effectively what I'm doing here today, is to say, you know, all these talented people here at South by Southwest, amazing talent, use that talent for your cities and your communities. So, you know, it's already happening. There's smart, capable people all over the country who are using their talents, stepping up and making cities work better for everyone using the web as a platform. At the end of last month, end of February, beginning of March, we had Code Across America, and we had 16 cities around the country where people like us got together and we hacked our cities. So in Norfolk, Virginia, close to where I live, we put out a public transit API for real-time bus, because you hear about people saying, oh, we don't need to build more real-time bus APIs. Well, we don't have one in my city, and I want one. And there's probably 10,000 cities around the country that don't have them who want them. All right, so that this was our way to sort of bootstrap this movement. We organized hundreds of people in a short amount of time to come together and start hacking and coding across America. Here's a picture of many of the events that took place. These are, you know, the hundreds of people who came together across the country to hack on their cities, and it's how this goes to something like this, right? So here's the app. You probably heard about it in the keynote. We're going to talk about it a lot. We're going to reinforce it. It's Adopt a Hydrant, and it was developed by a Code for America fellow, Eric Michaels Ober, to basically give citizens who wanted the ability to contribute to sign up and choose a fire hydrant to shovel out during a snowstorm. And so, you know, people like me and like you can build apps like this that make a difference. And what's cool about this thing is not just, I mean, it's obvious its functionality is cool and important. You know, fire hydrants that don't get shoveled out mean that the fire department has to do it, which means they spend less time fighting fires, right? But in addition, this is open source. It's repeatable. It's hackable. All right, so you could take something like this, and in Chicago, they turned it into adopt a sidewalk, right? And in technical terms, that means we turned it into from a point mapper to a polygon mapper. But so, you know, it's the people coming together in the rooms, hacking, creating the apps, leading to actual stuff getting done, right? I mean, a lot of attention is focused on the apps. It's really about getting stuff done. And it's about connecting to people where they already are, and where they are is here and here. All right? So let's put tools in their hands where they are to get them engaged with their government, engage with their communities, and make them better. You know, ultimately, you end up with a result, right? You end up with the shoveled out fire hydrant, or the tsunami siren that doesn't have its dead batteries, or the stormwater drain, which is important where I live in the Chesapeake Bay, that gets cleaned out. Because when stormwater drains are doing their job, they're full of trash, and somebody's got to go pick it up. And usually we wait for the city to do it. But why do we have to wait for the city to do that? We don't have to wait for the city to do it. We could just do it ourselves, and that's what we do. So, you know, you heard about the Code for America Brigade at the keynote probably, and I hope you'll hear a lot more about it, and I hope you'll sign on. What Brigade is civic hacker support. So we at Code for America want to help empower you to code for America in your cities and where you live. And so that's what Code for America Brigade is all about. It's about connecting people to projects and places. And those are pretty sweet icons, right, from me. Rounded corners.
Style.
You know, it's about connecting people to projects and places, all right? And we just launched a platform for it. It's called brigade.codeforamerica.org. I hope you'll check it out. I hope you will sign on. Deploy an app in your city. State a challenge. If you don't know how to deploy an app, if you don't think you're technical, if you don't think you have the right vocabulary, state a challenge. I want my city to publish real-time bus API. All right, we'll find out about it. The community of civic hackers will find out about it, and we'll rally toward one, you know, toward each other's support and get it done. All right, so that's Code for America Brigade. I thank you for your time, and I will pass it on.
So yeah, I think I'll delve into a little bit. My name is Aurelio Tino. I'm one of the Code for America fellows this year, assigned to the City of Austin. And you know, the topic for the panel is a cool, like you, government private sector envy. And then I just kind of want to delve into a little bit, like as to why someone from the private industry, like startup industry, would want to work for this, right? And then kind of go through it by recapping last year and what happened in my thought process and how I got influenced to joining this organization. But first off, again, like I'm work in San Francisco now. I grew up in Los Angeles, but in actuality, I'm from the internet. Like, and I can thank my dad for that. Like, he always like bought the latest toaster, like the shiny knives, and like my mom would like, what is this that you're getting for them? And then one thing was like, okay, I'm gonna get the kids the internet. It's this thing that I've been reading about. It will like change things. Like it will have such a big impact, and like it will even help topple governments, right? And it's like we've been waiting for that. Like it's been 22 years now. Like that was the early 90s, and then this happened like last year, right? It's in Egypt, but like and again, I'm not equating this. Like this happened solely because of the internet. Like it was a Tunisian vendor who set himself on fire that like kicked off all this, but the internet had a big part in spreading it and keeping it going, right? You had the way that it's been described is that people got together on Facebook. They coordinated themselves through Twitter in the event, and they broadcast themselves on YouTube after the fact. And it was like, just kind of going off on Jen's keynote, it's like things are changing. Like, you can feel it. Like, you know, just much like the highway system, like, there's these things where, first, like, just the infrastructure, the Ciscos, the Suns of the world, it's like laid that foundation out. Then, like, the second wave of, like, of the McDonald's and just kind of, like, connecting suburbia, that those are the Googles and Facebooks of the world, you know. And now, like, I feel like we are in this third wave, and, like, I wanted to be a part of that. And then, again, like, just kind of highlighting this throughout the year. And one thing that happened last year was I was here at South by Southwest, and the Japanese earthquake happened. And so what was more interesting was how quickly the community got together. Like, I remember seeing that tweet, like, in my hotel room that morning, just kind of like, oh, this thing's happening. And I go back to the convention center, and then there's, like, there's this movement already, like, just kind of, how can we as a community help out in Japan, right? So those are things that were happening in March. And then, again, a different thread, too. Like, prior to this, I worked for an organization called The Bay Citizen. It's a local news organization in the Bay Area. And then one thing over there, too, is just kind of, we got featured at Google I.O. for work I did in terms of a bike accident tracker. It was a quick project that I did. Like, that wasn't like I was a lead software engineer there. Like, I had more primary concerns of just keeping the site up, like various changes. But I got a taste of like the civic hacking, like a really good taste of it, and just kind of like at this point I started running into the fellows from last year's different meetups, and it's like, wow, like I can be doing this for an entire year, like. And like full time, it's like, all right, like I can buy into that. And so, again, like other things, this was top of my mind of, okay, I can be making more civic apps. And then other parts of it was like in May, my sister gave birth, and then I was like a godparent. And then in June, these two kids are not kids anymore. Like, I used to babysit these people, like they're like my little niece and nephew, and I was just like, holy cow, like I'm getting older, right? And it's just like, and then the thing that really struck me too was, like, these kids are smart. I tutored them, right? And then, but a lot of them and their friends, they didn't know what they were gonna do after they graduated. It's like, what's happening here? You know, it's like, okay, how has the generation prior than for our generation now? Like, okay, that's probably still left for debate, but then it really got to me, okay, as part of Generation Y, early part of Generation Y, like, when my niece and nephew grows up, like, what world do we leave for them? And then it just kind of started this, okay, I want to serve. Like, I want to, like, again, I'm not the most athletic guy, I'm not joining the military, but the skills I had was in coding. And so, so at this point, in July was also the time when the Code for America application was due. And I still just kind of like, it's just this thing I've heard about. And I remember the night exactly where there was just like, the CNN was on, like there was this death ceiling debate just back and forth. And I was just like, okay, this is it. Like, this is just ridiculous. And like, I'm pretty sure I was the last like fellow to apply last year. I was like, maybe 2 minutes into the like midnight deadline, I just like wrote that thing up, like just straight up answered it, and I applied, and then okay, let's see what happens. Then let's see, August, just kind of forgot about the application for a while, just like put it out there, and this other events are happening throughout the year, just kind of like reinforcing what we can do with the skills that we have. Again, I was working for a news organization, and like, there's, like, Aurelio, like, just, what's anonymous? Like, can you explain that to me? Like, all the editors and chiefs and just kind of, like, and then the other thing that happened in, like, in San Francisco is that, okay, there was one thing, there was another issue of why people were protesting, but people got really up in arms when they shut off the internet in the BART station. And it was like, okay, then the geeks and the internet sort of was like, they woke up to that. It's like, wait, what? You shut off our internet? Like, that's where I live. Like, no, you know, so it's just kind of like, I think there was just this entire last year, like, people in the tech community were waking up to this. Like, and so what happened? Again, in other events, like, the Occupy movement was very strong. and just kind of like just feeling that that sentiment there, right? And but the thing with, you know, I'm really like in support of the sentiment there, but sometimes like what they've been criticized for is like, okay, is it really, are you using your energy in the most positive way, like, or is it very clear? And so I felt like, okay, this hearing about this Organization Code for America, okay, like I can do something, like I will not just raise my voice, I will raise my hand and do some coding. So again, just referencing Jen's talks. And so September, and then we were gonna hear about whether or not we've been accepted, and I got the offer, and I signed the paperwork. Right, and I was like, all right, I will join Code for America. This is a great thing. But then there was still kind of a little bit of a, is this really the right thing? Like, I don't want to freak you out now, but like, okay, like even after I give you the paperwork, and I was like, right. And then, but then I did go to an event that Code for America was having where they had Anish Chopra presenting at the office. And then I was like, I mean, I was fully into it already, but like, there's just still that little bit of doubt. And then he was just talking about like, you know, like this thing that you guys are doing, it's open data, it's jet fuel for innovation. And then I was just like, all right, like, okay, like this guy sold me on it. And then that afternoon, the news broke out that actually Steve Jobs passed away, right? And then I was just like, all right, like what am I even like worrying about? It's like a year, like I can spend that time, and you know, like I can do this, like, and it was just like full on, okay, like I'm into this now. So yeah, it was from that moment on, it was just like, okay, I'm on this full on. And then again, the thing earlier about what happened with the Japanese earthquake was like that April I actually had plans to go over there for vacation, and it just kind of completely got derailed. But then, okay, now I'm on board Code for America. It doesn't start till January, and now I have time. So I did make the decision, fully on board. Then I went on vacation in Japan. There's nothing on here now. I already completely made the decision. Oh, and yeah, I decided to take my skills to Code for America and work in Austin. So it's my talents. Sorry. It's a LeBron James reference that he...
I made him say it. He's got to bring his skills to Austin.
So, so yeah, and again, just it was great. Like, I completely, fully on board now. Just, and then, again, I come back, though, and then, like, even more validation, right? Like, the SOPA and PIPA, and again, like, okay, how can I use my talents, my skill set, and help out with this larger trend that I feel like I'm seeing? And I think Code for America provides a great avenue to do that. And so... yeah, that's just a general walkthrough of my thought process for the year, and I'm enjoying it, and I think Emily will get into some more of what exactly the program entails. So.
Hi. Thanks for coming, guys. My name is Emily Wright, and I am a 2012 fellow, also with the City of Austin. I'm going to try and keep it really brief so that we have time for a few questions. I'm just going to outline the way the year works as a fellow, because I think it's a really, really impressive process. It's simple and to the point, and it moves really fast. So the month of January, we have an institute, which we spend time learning. Most of us have backgrounds with startups and technology, and we don't know anything about the way the government works, so we learn a little bit of that, as well as getting inspired about some of the cool things that are already happening. The February residency is 5 weeks where we spend in our cities, and March, which, you know, we're not all the way through yet, but we spend time talking about what we learned when in our cities, finding comparisons between all the different fellows and all the different teams, and what we're going to do next. Then the rest of the year, we go through fast product sprints. We go back and forth between the cities. We test out what we've made. And in November, we have a summit bringing everyone together to talk about everyone being our cities and all the cities, as well as tech leaders and interesting people to discuss what we've made and what we've discovered and what we found. There were 550 applicants for the 2012 fellows, and 26 of them were selected, which makes me feel pretty special as a designer. And 28 is the average age, which is also kind of interesting. There are 6 teams of 3, 2 teams of 4, and it's an 11-month program for a modest stipend. Here are the participating cities this year: Santa Cruz, Honolulu, Austin, New Orleans, Macon, Chicago, Detroit, and Philadelphia. Last year there were 3 cities, 18 or 19 fellows, I'm not really sure, and they built 21 applications, which is pretty impressive, but we're gonna build more. Here are the speakers that we had come to us in January, a pretty impressive list of people that I was aware of some of them beforehand, but now I know them all personally, which I think is pretty amazing. Here's us in January listening to Eric Ries and David Benetti, and there they are talking to us. Just an average day of us talking and learning in January. This is the 2011 fellows coming back to tell us about what they learned, and that's all of us this year. So we spent 35 days in Austin, and this is sort of a breakdown of what we were able to do. We had over 80 meetings. We met with over 25 city departments. We met with quite a few community groups and community leaders. We were able to put together one hackathon as part of the Code Across, which had 3 apps that were almost launched or almost in completion. Some really exciting stuff and projects that were proposed by people in the community and then built by other people in the community, which I think is with government or the data portal data. Moving forward, this is the hackathon space that we had. We were able to get a great space donated. This is before everybody arrived. I think we had 65 people RSVP, and I think they all came in the morning, and about 30 stayed throughout the whole day, which is pretty impressive. This is everybody getting started in the morning. And here's some of our staff, our visits. We went to the Emergency Response Center, and they were able to talk to us and tell us some of the problems that they're facing. This is just a breakdown of March onwards, which I already sort of covered. So that being said, I think that's it for me. Thank you.
Great, and special kudos to Emily for being the only one to stick to her time. I think we all went over a little bit, and apologize for that, because we do definitely want to have time for questions. And so I think one thing that was really good about the panel is we did have a lot of different points of view and different experiences that talked about how we go from being government business as usual to being government something new and innovative. So with that, we'll open it up to some questions from the crowd. And if you can, please speak into the microphone, since this is a podcast and we want to make sure we capture your question.
Hi. So I've been to a lot of these talks about big data and open government and, you know, Code for America, all these initiatives. And maybe I haven't been going to the right talks, there's so much, but I haven't heard a whole lot of how this relates to, like, the nonprofit sector. I hear about, like, private-public partnerships, but I look at the nonprofits, and, you know, with government, I'm voting for someone that I don't really like because there's nobody better, and they're going to decide how to spend my money. But with a nonprofit, I can take my own money, and I can vote with it to spend money on cancer versus my kid's school versus helping the public or the volunteer firefighters. And it seems like all these things I'm hearing, are there initiatives in that community as well? Or is the government initiatives, are you working with the nonprofits at all? I mean, to empower people through those nonprofits to do a lot of these same kinds of civic efforts. It just seems like that would be a huge vehicle, and there would actually be some convergence between the role of government and some of the services that the nonprofits provide over time.
I'll take a crack at that. It is something that we're looking at. In fact, here in Austin, we started a citizens advisory group that would be kind of a guide for some of our technology issues. And in that group, we actually did look specifically at nonprofit organizations, groups that were not only involved in issues of digital divide, but also in different issues related to housing, to, you know, basically we kind of looked at all the different organizations in Austin and said, let's try to get these people involved. I think there were other models that we were interested in, and I don't know if Julio wants to jump in at some point, but we were really kind of looking to see if Open Austin could also, you know, in some way, because of their advocacy role, involve more of those groups and not just be purely a technology group, but also a group that represented all different types of interests, not only, you know, in terms of what government does, but how you can kind of bring nonprofits and other organizations into the discussion. You know, I'm not sure if anybody else has an example. I think, you know, well, for Austin, I mean, it was something that was born out of our relationship with Open Austin and our kind of link to the community. I don't know if anybody else had a comment.
I mean, Code for America is a nonprofit, so.
Yeah.
I mean, we met with several nonprofits, and we've been working to bring them in
to
the city.
But it seems like everyone from, you know, people who raise money for cancer research to local schools trying to raise money for their school, it just seems like across the board there could be that kind of initiative.
Very quickly, nonprofits are essential. Paul here has a little button from Random Hacks of Kindness where some of the civic applications that we developed, one of them, the one that I worked on, was focused on a nonprofit. I believe at the February hackathon, in general, at the hackathons, the problem statements can come from the nonprofit domain. Some of the examples that I put up in my presentation of organizations like GiveWell, which is about evaluating charity to some extent, or the Society for Social Impact Analysis, people who live in Excel world. One of the most popular data sets when we had the open data, what data do you want from the city, idea scale thingamajigger, was core data for things that human services providers constantly are looking for. Census counts, this for services, X, Y, or Z. So there are many opportunities. I would say, right, let's build the world that we want, because I think there are many places for that kind of collaboration.
Right, next question.
Hi. Thanks so much for sharing your stories here. I'm not a programmer, but besides joining a brigade from the design team or some other perspective, what else can I do to help spread the word about this kind of thing? Like, given that I have a large Twitter network or a large LinkedIn network, what else do you need to do for fans to help take these ideas to scale?
Well, definitely connecting with groups like Open Austin. Where are you from?
New York.
Okay. So in New York, actually, and related to the last question, we're working with NYU, Wagner School of Public Policy, and the whole intent of it is to bring together the nonprofit organizations with the civic hacking community. So if you connect there, that's a way. And if you say that you have networks in New York that you want to share the information, then join the brigade or contact me directly or contact Jack, and we'll help get you connected, and then anything you can share from where you live, we just want to scale that.
Yeah. So I guess that the brigades would include ways for projects like people who need no borders or like consulting firms who have software engineers who want to donate their time. Do you think that's other projects on there that are like 10-hour projects or small projects that are easy to do on weekends, I guess?
So it's really defined by the local communities. Data Without Borders is definitely a group that we talk to there. And the size of the projects, I mean, it doesn't even have to be an app. It could be creating an open data directive for your local council, just getting them to adopt one, or publishing a data set, or teaching somebody in a civic community to stand up a WordPress site because their site looks like it was from 1993 or whatever. So there's a lot of different ways, and you don't have to be, you could be an organizer like me.
Is there one more question here in the front?
So I'm glad you're bringing up the issue of community organizing, since one of the things that John Tolva, who you all know, who's a CTO in Chicago, has brought up is the need for a lot of the people who are interested in this space to talk to people who have been working to improve cities for a long time, and there's a disconnect sometimes in the community. And going to lots of these panels here at South By, I'm wondering about that sometimes. It seems like people really excited developers and entrepreneurs want to bolt on a new way of doing things to the existing infrastructure, right? And the piece of pushback I'm seeing on the social web right now is when Jen quoted Clay Johnson about rewiring government. People say, whoa, well, we have wiring for government. It's in the Constitution, right? So, you know, why aren't those architectures of participation that exist in the real world being replicated in a way that works for citizens online, right? So the question, though, is actually maybe more existential one. It's not about tech. It's about culture. Yeah. It's about this thing where you say, you know, I want to put my hands to work, not just raise my voice. And you all give a platform and a vector for that, an example for that. But do we have enough engaged citizens to do that, right? Are people willing to step up on their day-to-day, step away from the TV, watching 35 hours a week of TV? Are they stepping away from the video games now? They'll step away from TMZ and celebrity culture and all these other things that make up our culture to do this, right? The fellows are inspiring, right? But the brigades is another thing. How are you going to get that cultural bit? And because I'm seeing that pushback in my stream from people who are pretty jaded at the New York Times and saying, this sounds great, guys, but we watch what citizens actually do on a daily basis. How are you going to get them to come and actually contribute?
Well, one way, I think, and just to use a very specific example from where I live, I work with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, and every year on the first Saturday in June, they have this thing called Clean the Bay Day, and 7,500 people plus from all the states around the Chesapeake Bay come out to clean up their environment. So right there, they're already engaged, and what I see as an opportunity is they're collecting all their data and reporting all their information on pen and paper. So it's just a real simple thing to say, look, use your smart devices to take a picture, geolocate it, and send it to Twitter. And so it's not that we're trying to take people from where they are and put them online. And it's not that they're not already engaged. They are already engaged. We're just trying to make that engagement a little bit more seamless, a little bit more permissionless, a little bit work more like the internet.
What are Code for America's goals over the next, say, few years, and what challenges do you see in reaching those goals?
Jen? Abby? Jen?
This is a test.
Yeah. I think...
What are our goals over the next... How long?
3-5
So I think our goals are to learn a lot. Basically. So we're really new, and sometimes the story gets a little ahead of itself. We've done 1 year of this with 3 cities. We are now doing a second year with 8 cities and 26 fellows, but it's not like we're experts at this. So I don't know. I really resist the temptation to look that far into the future without kind of having a commitment to getting what we're doing now right. You know, the question I get most often is, are we going to scale to the county, state, federal levels of government? And I think we'll probably scale to counties, because a lot of what cities do overlap what counties do. But our model isn't sort of to just, like, go in there and do random stuff. Like, we're trying to do stuff that's reusable and create a new model for government IT. And if you start projects at the state level, they're not necessarily reusable at the city and county level. And the federal government, frankly, is really hard to work with. I mean, I think that you can, but we want it. We're small. We're 10 staff. We're 26 fellows, and we don't have a giant procurement department. And we work. We get eight contracts a year now, I guess, from city governments, and that seems to me like a good agenda for the next couple of years. I hate to be not too ambitious about it, but I'd like to get really good at what we're doing now. Is that okay?
Works for me.
Totally.
Actually, I think we're out of time. We will be available afterwards here in the area if you want to ask additional questions. And City Hall tonight, remember that we're having our event to promote the Brigade with Code for America. It's at 6:30, Austin City Hall. We'd like to see you all there.
There will be beer.
There will be beer.